In this lecture of Unit 5, Component 2, we will discuss interventions and how they are assessed in evidence-based medicine. This category of question is called treatment or therapy. However, intervention might be a better term, as there are other ways that we intervene beyond treatment in our efforts to improve health and eliminate disease. When evidence-based medicine is used to assess questions about interventions, the concern is about the benefit of a clinical intervention to treat or prevent disease. There is no intervention that this approach cannot be applied to, such as drug therapy, diet therapy, surgery, and complementary and alternative medicine. The best evidence for assessing an intervention comes from a randomized controlled trial, or even better, a meta-analysis of multiple randomized controlled trials. A key aspect of a randomized controlled trial is that patients are similar in all regards, with the exception of the intervention applied. This is the ideal. However, it is important to carefully assess this aspect when appraising a study, as the ideal conditions are not always present. Randomized controlled trials provide the best evidence for interventions, because they allow us to reduce bias when subjects do not know what treatment they are getting. For example, most of you probably know someone who touts the benefits of vitamin C in preventing the common cold. Maybe even you do. We all know people who say that since they started taking vitamin C, they never get colds. However, the reality is that there have been more than 30 randomized controlled trials when you eliminate the bias to people knowing if they are taking either vitamin C or a placebo. There is no difference in the number of colds that people get. Another example is the Women's Health Initiative. Prior to this study, there was strong belief that postmenopausal estrogen replacement therapy was beneficial for women, that it reduced heart disease and cognitive deficits. However, all of this was overturned by this very well-designed randomized controlled trial. Another benefit for randomized controlled trials is that they tend to focus on clinical endpoints and patient-oriented outcomes, or at least they should. In the 1980s, it was common to prescribe lidocaine whenever someone had a myocardial infarction to suppress cardiac rhythm abnormalities, in the belief that this would prevent things like fatal ventricular fibrillation. However, the cardiac arrhythmia suppression trial, which randomized people to lidocaine or not, showed that not only was there no benefit for lidocaine, but it was actually dangerous, bringing a quick end to that practice. There is also the view that anything new is better. One researcher looked at radiation oncology trials and noticed that new treatments were just as likely as not to be successful. Just because something new is introduced does not mean we cannot test it out. However, it needs to be done in a randomized controlled trial to demonstrate if it is really better. There have been other interesting findings about randomized controlled trials over the years. One is that there seems to be an inverse relationship between the quality of the study and the magnitude of the treatment effect. The better the design of the study, the lower the treatment effect, or the benefit of the treatment. We will see how this is actually measured in a moment. It has also been found that evidence of lower quality, particularly non-randomized controlled trials, is more likely to be later overturned than good high-quality evidence. However, it should be noted that well-designed observational studies where you do not randomize and control people may be just as good if the observational studies are well-designed and well carried out. There is a fascinating history of randomized controlled trials. It is often said that the first randomized controlled trial was performed by Dr. James Lind, who was a British naval doctor and surgeon in the 1700s. He performed experiments where he did and did not give citrus fruits, in particular lemons and oranges, to sailors. He noticed unequivocally that the sailors who were administered citrus fruits did not develop scurvy, which of course is caused by vitamin C deficiency. Those who did not get the citrus fruits were much more likely to develop scurvy. The first true randomized controlled trial was performed in the United Kingdom in the 1940s. It was a trial that looked at the treatment of tuberculosis, and it compared streptomycin, an early antibiotic for tuberculosis, with a placebo. This study demonstrated clear superiority for the antibiotic. How do we critically appraise a study about an intervention? In the previous lecture, we discussed three questions that we ask of any study. Are the results of the study valid? What do the results show? Can the results be applied to patient care? Or, if you are actually a clinician taking care of a patient, the last question would be, can the results be applied to my patient? To determine whether results are valid, we ask if the experimental and control groups began the study with a similar prognosis. Were the patient groups identical? Were the patients then randomized into the control or experimental treatment? Was the randomization concealed from the clinician? Did the clinician have absolutely no role in the randomization? Because if the clinician can bias the randomization, then they will bias the trial. Were the patients analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized, sometimes called intent to treat analysis? Then, were the patients in the treatment and control groups similar with respect to the known prognosis? Sometimes the randomization does not work, and we end up with somewhat different groups, and that causes us to have concerns about the validity of the randomized controlled trial. There are more questions to ask about the validity of the results. In particular, did the experimental control groups retain a similar prognosis after the study started? Were the patients aware of what group they were allocated to? Were the clinicians aware? Or were the assessors or the people judging the output of the study aware? Now, in some studies, the patients know what group they are allocated to. For example, in a study about surgery, where the clinicians obviously know as well. But you want to make sure that the randomization process works and that the assessors, to the best extent possible, are not aware of the group allocation. We also need to know that the follow-up was complete, that a large proportion of patients were not lost to follow-up. Once we are confident that the study is valid, we can then proceed to look at the results. There are two major issues to consider. First, how large was the treatment effect? Or how beneficial was it, if indeed it was beneficial? Next, how precise was the estimate of treatment effect? With the treatment effect, we ask about both the relative risk reduction and the absolute risk reduction. For the precision of the treatment effect, we basically need to know whether it is statistically significant, so we need to know the confidence in our roles or the p-values for the experiments. Once we know the treatment effect, we can then ask if the results can be applied to patient care. Were the study patients similar to my patient? If they were not, then there may be some issues about the generalizability of the results. Were all the clinically important outcomes considered? Even though there is always a primary outcome in a study, did they look at other outcomes as well, so that we can assess the larger perspective of the intervention benefit? And then, are the likely treatment benefits worth the potential harm and costs? We will see that randomized controlled trials do not always do a good job of accounting for adverse effects. But we must analyze the reports of adverse effects so that we can balance the benefits and harms.